Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear John, KC2 WGB. John and Dick try to run this thing called the Technical Net most Sunday evenings. Very enthusiastic crew of ham radio operators meet, a meeting of the clan, gathering of the clan, in which we share information with each other as to how to get more enjoyment out of this hobby, how does all this hardware work, how to make it work better, how to understand it more, and other variations of things like that. A person signs into the Technical Net by giving John and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need that sign in just because you're listening. I believe this is TechNet number 1,444 of the series that began 30 years ago in September of 1982. It's been around a while. In sheer number of hours, let me drop it. Sheer number of hours of on-the-air time under essentially the same leadership, we believe this is one of the longest-running ham radio nets that has been around. And it won an award from the ARRL 2 years ago for the service that it provides. The questions that are asked on the Technical Net during the first hour are usually pure ham radio type. John and I try to make a promise that you'll get at least a simple answer during the first hour. You shouldn't have to wait longer than an hour to get an answer. Beyond the first hour, John goes to the mailbag for the people who don't yet have their ham license or don't yet have the right kind of equipment to give coverage. And you can get coverage to this machine by way of the 146.85 input on the Queens-Nassau border, the 147.375 input in Selden, Long Island, by way of EchoLink, by way of IRLP. So there's at least four ways, if not more, that you can sign on to this repeater. And for those who don't have one of those four ways, don't have the license yet, not in the right location, don't have the right equipment, and particularly beginners that have a question, they send an email or snail mail to John. He selects the ones that are most universal sounding, and we discuss two, three, or four of those at around 9 or 9:15 or so. After that, John? After that, Paul will discuss the latest on what National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. Last week, we had a significant discussion on that, and just this week, the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer has made some further discoveries with reference to the dark energy. Also, that subject was discussed at the Astronomy Open Night at Stony Brook University last Friday night. The first Friday of each month, approximately, Stony Brook University has, free to the public, starting at 7:30, a very nice astronomy section where one of their 10 or so people who have doctorate degrees in astronomy, the astronomy department, gives a lecture, and the last lecture was on the subject of dark energy, followed by a viewing of their 14-inch and 8-inch telescopes on the roof of the building. So a good session was had there. Alrighty. One other thing I wanted to mention is the fact that don't worry about the question you're asking the TechNet. At times the TechNet gets into some pretty deep stuff, and at times some pretty shallow stuff. There's no such thing as a dumb question. A so-called dumb question really is a question representing a larger distance between what the person knows and what he would like to know. So with the proper kind of non-prejudice, we'd like to believe there is no such thing as a dumb question. So if you think you've got a question, but you're afraid it's a dumb one, don't worry. Just ask it. You won't get chastised. We go easy with people. Alrighty, at this time, give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW listening.
W2RIY, Joe, yes.
For Delta 2, Bravo Hotel Yankee, James and yes.
N2MB, no questions, just want to say hi.
N2XGN, off the pole.
Okay, we've got Joe, Jim, Barry, Wes in that order. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
KD2CXK,
10WS2N, Paul, base report. Good evening, Dick.
Very fine, Greg and Paul. And one last call. Anyone else to check into the TechNet with a question or comment? Give me a call that is a name right now. We got more than enough to get going. Joe, W2RYY. What's the latest in your neighborhood? K2RIW. My name is Dick. You know that, but I'm telling other people.
Good evening, Dick. How you doing? W2RYY. I'd like to know about through the mount, through the glass type of antennas that are used on vehicles for VHF and UHF transmission. I know there's several different makes and models out there. Maybe you know something about them, maybe some other people on the net know something about them. I'd like to know something about what to look for, what to stay away from, and so forth, as far as even maybe models to look for, and so forth. It's not specifically for my purposes, because I just drill a hole in the car body, put an antenna through it, and be done with it, but there is some people I do know that have, expensive vehicles that they'd like to consider putting a through the window type of glass mount antenna for VHF, UHF amateur operation. Back to you.
You've got a good question, Joe, and I'm going to back up a little bit and address it in a slightly more general way. When it comes to putting an antenna on an automobile for 2 meters and 450, for instance, in my mind, the most ideal antenna is one that's high in performance and does the least amount of marring of the surface or damage to the automobile. The traditional guys in the past thought the only way to get good performance is to drill a hole in the roof and put a through-the-roof hole mount into an antenna. That hard mounting is the only way to go. Mag mounts were considered somewhat controversial in those days because the mag mount doesn't make direct contact with the metal of the car, but by way of the capacitance on that magnet in the bottom, the thin piece of plastic which gives you a significant capacitor, and people believed that that capacitor was a lossy medium. It is not. If it's part of the design of the antenna, that capacitor is just a series reactance with the antenna that doesn't change its efficiency in any way. It can get to nearly 100% efficiency with a capacitively coupled antenna. When it comes to bringing the lead of a mag mount into the car, people usually start off with bringing the lead in through a window, and they soon realize that's not very desirable. Or they bring it in through the rubber seal at the top of the door. And pretty soon they realize that when it rains, water walks along the side of the cable, and you get some dripping water on the floor in the car, and that's not pleasant. We drop. In my case, I found a way that works for me with my four-door sedan. My rear right-hand door is the one I use the least, and so I bring that cable through the edge of the door, but not across the rubber seal. And then I walk that around the back edge of the door. Is it the back edge or the forward edge? Yeah, the back edge, I think it is. Walk it around toward the bottom of the door. Then I allow it to cross the rubber. Then it goes directly across that rubber, inside the car, underneath the rug, and then up to the amplifier and receiver that's in the front of the car near the passenger compartment. So by bringing the cable, holding it down with tape, inside that channel of the door, on the outside of the rubber seal, but inside of the lip of the door, where it becomes hidden from the outside world. You see the coax cable, the RG58, going into the crack of the door, and you assume it's going directly across the rubber seal. That's not the way I do it. I wrap it around the perimeter of the door down to the bottom, and that way the water that tries to get in has to go uphill, if you know what I mean. It doesn't do that, so I don't get water in the car anymore. For me, that works. Now, through the glass is another approach of getting the signal from inside the car to outside the car. Let me drop. And the way that technique usually works is there's a coax cable from the transceiver going up to the nearest window, and the shield is connected usually to the metal of the car nearby the edge of the window, and the semiconductor of the shield goes to some kind of a capacitive plate on the windshield itself. On the outside of the windshield is the opposite. There is a capacitive plate going to the semiconductor of the cable, going to the antenna, and the shield again picks up the metal of the car. It's the way it's usually done. And it could be done with a double side-by-side capacitive coupling through the glass, where no metal contact is required. In the case of feeding the signal from the capacitance of the windshield, that again is a series capacitor that can be tuned out with the right kind of an impedance matching network at that location, or at another location, downrange on the cable, so to speak. And as long as you know the amount of area in square centimeters of the metal plate inside the car, the metal plate outside the car, the thickness of the glass in between, the dielectric content of the glass, you can calculate how many picofarad capacitance you've got. And let me pick a number. If you make that capacitance, picofarads, big enough so that the reactance goes down to, let me pick a number, 5 or 10 ohms, and if that 5 or 10 ohms is part of a capacitive tuning network, you can get to 98% of the signal through the glass, with one or two exceptions. On some automobiles, the glass contains a tin oxide conductive layer. The reason you put tin oxide on the touch plate of your cell phone or on your windshield is that it's optically transparent but conductive, electrically conductive. So the heating element that some automobiles have to defrost the windshield is a metallic object, and whether or not the signal will go through that metallic object without loss or without coupling.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So in the place of automobiles that have that metallic plate built into the windshield, whether or not the through-the-glass type antenna coupler works well is something that amateurs have discussed. I don't know if anyone has actually gone out and make a measurement. When in doubt, make measurements as opposed to speculating. But that's one of the things that I worry about. Now, I've never used a through-the-glass type antenna coupling in an automobile. I'll bet you some of you guys have. So if you'll now give me your call letters and tell us your experience, we'd like to hear from you. So give me your call letters and name right now if you've got experience with through-the-glass capacitive coupling type arrangement in your car. Also, once in a while, we should let the machine completely drop, the four beeps and then a complete drop, so that the people in the outer areas are able to assign if they want to. So give a long drop and then give me your call letters and name if you've got information on the subject. K2LIW listening.
82 AMZ.
Get out of the car.
Yeah, I'm trying to wait until the machine fully drops. AMZ, go right ahead.
Very good, Dick. I've had experience with through-the-glass mount installations. I performed one for a buddy of mine in Pennsylvania, strictly 2-meter. For his particular case, it worked extremely well. It was in a truck. But one of the most important things, which you have to make sure that the weather is perfectly dry. I made the mistake of doing it right after a rain and it was still damp, and it didn't quite work until everything dried out completely, but it worked extremely well, and the manufacturer was Larson, and as you said, this was a capacitive mount with the glue pads or whatever you want to call them. And the very important thing, which I've also learned, is they have an activator, and if you don't use the activator or if the activator is dry, get a new one. It's very critical, otherwise the antenna will fall off on the outside. 82 AMZ.
Yeah, I hate it when that happens. Very well, Mike. Now, my question is, did you put your through-the-glass antenna on the forward windshield, or a side window, or the rear windshield? I'm going to guess it possibly was the forward windshield. Did yours require any extra metal contact to the frame of the car? I'm going to guess the answer was no. I'm guessing that the center conductor came up to some kind of a small box on the inside of the car that got glued to the windshield, and then there's a similar box and or antenna on the outside, so that both shield and center conductor of the coax cable both got coupled to the windshield, is what I think you're telling me. So give us a few answers on some of those questions and any further information there, Mike. How long have you been using it? Still using it? Are you happy with it? KD2AMZ, K2RIW TechNet. You got it, Mike.
attaching to the metal. It was strictly a box capacitor on one side, capacitor on the other, or a plate. The one thing I did have to do, though, is I had to tune the antenna by raising the stub up and down with a set screw and a SWR meter, because the SWR apparently is different for every installation and angle that you set the antenna to, and I did it to a back window of a pickup truck and KD2AMZ. And the last question that I forgot to is it worked perfectly well until it fell off. When it fell off, I bought it through HRO. They sent an immediate replacement, and as far as the last I heard, it's working perfectly a year later.
So the rear window of a pickup truck. Now, you would think on the rear window of a pickup truck, the antenna would have fallen onto the bed of the truck, therefore you didn't lose it. But I think you said that Lawson mailed you another one. Give us a few words on that one, Mike. Go ahead.
It did fall into the back of the pickup truck, but the glue pads were destroyed. So I had to scrape the outside of the window with a razor blade, clean it with alcohol. But they sent a remount kit, is what they call it, because the antenna itself wasn't damaged, and I used the remount kit, and it worked perfectly. But every time you install it, you have to tune the antenna by raising the stub up and down with a set screw. Once I did that, it worked perfectly for my buddy out there in Pennsylvania, and I haven't heard a peep, so obviously it must be working.
That's rather good news, Mike. And the fact that you've got to tune it for each individual installation doesn't surprise me. Depending on how nearby is the metal of the car, how thick is the glass, what brand of glass, how many layers to the safety glass, and so on, it changes the amount of capacitance that has to be tuned out. Two more questions, Mike. Number one, do you believe it was a quarter wave or was it a 5/8 wave type? What did they claim? I think you said it was Lawson brand name. And what was the approximate price class? Was that a $120 antenna, so to speak? KD2AMZ, K2LIW. Go ahead, Mike.
No, I don't remember whether it was a quarter wave or 5/8 wave. Looking about the size of it for 2 meter, it was about a quarter wave just by looking at the size of it. And it was about 100 and change in the price range. About $120, $150, something in that price range. It's been a while, it's been over a year since I've installed it.
I should have asked you, roughly how many watts did you put into it? Did Lawson claim that there's any limitation on wattage? Through the glass, at the 50-watt level that many of our mobile rigs work, I wouldn't worry. But if you're one of those really enthusiastic guys that wants to run single sideband and 1,000 watts of it from its automobile, and there are a few of those, my gut feels you'd be pushing your luck on through the glass and 1,000 watts. Did Lawson claim how many watts you should not exceed, Mike? KD2AMZ, K2LIW?
If I remember correctly, it was like the 50 to 75 watt range. In addition, it had the mini 8 or 58U cable. It wasn't any chunky cable. So obviously you couldn't use 1,000 watts. Based purely on the cable itself. And again, if I remember correctly, it was you could use it for like a 75-watt radio up into that kind of power range. A normal mobile power range.
Well, the word normal power range is a little bit different to me. I spent a couple of years of my life every weekend traveling to Utica, New York, to the Rome Air Development Center. And the mobile rig I was running on 2 meters was single sideband with a 5/8 wave mag mount on the roof as well as a square loop on the roof fed with RG58. And my amplifier in the car was running a Mirage amplifier, rated for 160 watts, but my particular automobile gave it the full 13.8 or 9 volts, and I got 180 watts out. So I was running 180 watts of sideband into a mag mount antenna. Everything worked like a charm for all of those years. The nice thing about sideband, although the peak envelope power may be 180 watts, the average power is a hell of a lot lower. And when you overload something, most of the time it's the loss mechanism is extra heating, and it's, and the amount of heating you get is due to average power, not peak power, as long as things are not arcing over. So with single sideband, without extremely heavy speech processing, I think you could go above the 50 or 75 watts that Lawson recommends. That's an opinion. I haven't done it with through the glass. So I wonder if, Joe, these are some of the questions you're looking for the answers to. WQRYY, the guy who asked the original question, KQRAW in the TechNet.
Very good. Well, I've heard the company Larson before. It seemed like a pretty decent company to deal with, and I haven't heard too many complaints about it. So it's always good to put something like this out on the TechNet so you get some feedback from other people and see what kind of experience they've had with something like this. But I'm looking to suggest this to a friend of mine who has a fairly expensive car who doesn't want to put any holes in it or run a magma, and he'd like to put a through-the-glass type of PHWHF antenna, and I don't think he's going to be kind of running more than 50 watts of power. So back to you, Dick.
Yeah, in my opinion, Joe, you don't have to put any kind of holes in the car. If you're running a mag mount and run the RG58 cable across the lip of one door, a rear door of the car, around the perimeter of that door, outside of the rubber, and then cross the rubber down at the bottom of the door, and hold it on with the duct tape or whatever, if you want to make sure that, and by the way, with proper taping, you can open that door and nobody is the wiser, if you know what I mean. Your foot doesn't interfere with anything. In my case, I don't even put tape there, so I don't use that door. Although the cable tends to hold itself, once in a while somebody will open that door. So by way of that technique of a mag mount, again, direct connection by coax cable to the antenna, which I think is a little bit easier than through the glass gluing. But that's just me. And as I said, I make no marks at all on the car. As long as the piece of plastic on the bottom of the mag mount is doing its job correctly, I'm not putting any scratches on the top of the car. I will admit that after using a mag mount for 3 solid years on a car, that because the shadow of the... Let me see.
Okay, the last video I called you a mysterious man from far away, and and I think the other time was not good for me, because he was reported. Oh, no, yeah. Nobody saw your face, and nobody knows...
My voice is there.
What? You what? You what?
My voice.
Your what?
Yeah.
A voice? Nobody gonna attack it.
Okay, I hope so. Okay, yeah, this is a minor concern, not the biggest concern at the moment. The concern is how you can make it as good coordination as you can.
Okay.
So,
it's full scale at my location.
Okay,
but I need a chemical.
Three. As far as the remount kit goes, I'll bet you could use what people use to reattach their rear view mirror. It's probably the same thing, because they mount that on the glass a lot of times.
Negative, this is KD2AMZ. Do not use that. It's specially made for the capacitance issues.
Very good. Okay. Yeah, I think somebody was sitting on a microphone by mistake and then probably eventually realized it. So you don't have to put them on. So starting to say, after 3 years of the mag mount being left in one particular position on the roof of my car, my maroon-colored automobile with sun shining down on it, the paint very slightly faded after 3 years, and the lack of sun exposure in the one spot where the mag mount was located means that the coloring of the paint there is very slightly darker than the other places. Had I been real smart and moved the mag mount around periodically, even that problem wouldn't go away. But no real marks on my car by way of mag mount. So I'm a mag mount enthusiast. The nice thing I like about the mag mount is that if I drive into a metro area like New York City and I don't want to advertise the fact that there's a ham radio on board, I can easily pick up that mag mount off the roof, put it in the rear seat on the floor of the back of the car, and then nothing shows, if you know what I mean. And to reestablish it takes me about 30 seconds. So I like the fact of the portability of the mag mount and the fact that I make no marks on the car, no cut no holes, don't have to mount any tape or whatever with my particular method. So that's the way I do it. Any further comments, Joe? Oh, what was I going to say? Yeah, Larson, $120. Looks like people are reasonably happy with it. Any final comments, Joe, before we move on? W2RYY, K2RIW, the Tech Man.
No more comments here. I'll have to check out the website for Larson and see what they have to say about the whole thing, what they have to offer currently, what's available. Thanks, Nick.
And I intentionally gave a time for the machine to really drop. The people in Canada are telling me that unless our machine completely drops once in a while, it doesn't reset things up there and they get locked out. Okay, the next guy was Jim, KD2BHY. How are things going with you, Jim? From time to time, I hear people giving you books and giving you pieces of equipment. We like the fact that we worry. We older, white-haired amateurs, Jim, we worry about the fact that the average age of ham radio operators is increasing, and we worry about the fact that the younger generation is so hell-bent on handheld computers and desktop computers and games and whatever that we're afraid that there's not enough young hams. So when one comes along, and you don't consider yourself young, we do. Compared to our age, you're a youngster. And we like supporting youngsters, as you can tell. So you put out the right word periodically, and we'll pile things on you, Jim. KD2BHY, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Definitely. Thanks, Dick. I made the measurements that... last week, I made the measurements that you told me to make on the transmitter, and... I didn't get any voltage across the resistors, probably because I shorted it out somewhere, or I have an open circuit somewhere, or I might have wired something wrong, but yeah, I'm just having a bit of trouble with the wiring, if there's anything I can do.
In the case of no voltage across the resistors, it suggests the voltage is not getting there. The voltage is not getting there because between the battery and the beginning of your circuit, there's an open circuit. You think you've got an on-off switch and you're thinking it's making contact. Maybe it's not. By starting off with your voltmeter first across the battery, in other words, the black lead goes to the negative voltage on your battery, the red lead goes to the positive lead, and then you leave the black lead on the battery continuously. You take the red lead and you slowly walk it along the circuit. You see the voltage coming out of the battery. And by the way, if the battery is going into a short circuit, that voltage would drop real fast. If the battery is putting out normal voltage, say for instance you're running three dry cells, and therefore you should see 4.5 volts in my example, 1.5 times 3. You see 4.5 volts at the battery. You go to the other end of that wire where it goes to the switch, you see 4.5 volts. You go to the far side of the switch when the switch is turned on, and you see 0. And then you would know, hey, the voltage is not getting through the switch. And so you'll walk your way along. You're eventually going to find a place where the voltage is or it isn't. That's called the troubleshooting technique, or what do you call it, a signal tracing. In your case, you're doing one of the simplest kinds of signal tracing, D+, what we call it, voltage signal placing, signal tracing of the voltage out of the battery. Also, by putting your volt-ohm milliammeter in series with the red lead, you can measure the current. And so if it was drawing zero current, again, it's strongly suggesting of an open circuit. Any reasonable transmitter with the voltage being applied to it is going to draw some number of milliamps or hundreds of milliamps of current. And if it draws 0 milliamps and your meter is working correctly, then it again is a strong indication of an open circuit. If I measure 0 voltage across all resistors, one of the first things I'd worry about is the voltmeter working. And by putting it across the battery directly, you can find out. So give me a couple more of those measurements that I just suggested now, if you have made them already. And if not, make them during the net and come back to us and tell us what you find. KD2BHY, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Thanks, Dick. Yeah, I got nothing across both resistors. I measured the battery voltage. I got 9 volts out of it, which is what I'm using, so that's good. I know the battery is working. I just have a wire wrong because it's so densely packed. I did kind of a stupid thing where I just I packed it so densely on this breadboard for no reason at all. I think I should spread out the parts a little bit. And I'll definitely make some more measurements. Could you explain to me that technique that you were talking about before where you walk the positive lead across the breadboard? Because that sounds very useful.
Boy, am I glad you asked. Okay, when it comes to signal tracing, if, for instance, I had a receiver where the antenna is connected, the receiver is turned on, and I'm getting nothing out of the loudspeaker, if you have the right kind of sensitive instrumentation, like a spectrum analyzer, you literally start off at the antenna, connect the spectrum analyzer at the antenna, and say, yep, there's a signal there. Say, for instance, the broadcast receiver. I'm seeing the broadcast receiver signal. And then I go through the first mixer stage, and I make a measurement out of that stage, and I'm changing the frequencies that I'm seeing on the spectrum analyzer, but I'm seeing the signal, and it got a little bit stronger because that stage has got gain. And I go to the first IF amplifier, and I see the signal getting stronger. So when it comes to signal tracing of signal with something like a spectrum analyzer, that's one of the very useful things to learn. You are in the lucky situation where you don't even need a $3,000 spectrum analyzer to do the signal tracing. To you, a $10 volt ohm milliammeter will do it. Your signal tracing of battery voltage. So, by as I said before, let me drop the black lead, the negative lead out of your voltmeter. You're going to connect it to the minus 12 volt. Here we go, minus 9 volts out of your battery, and you're going to leave it there. The red lead, the positive lead, you start off at the battery, and you see 9 volts. That 9 volts goes through a wire, probably to your on-off switch. Measure at the input end of the on-off switch and the output end of the on-off switch with the red lead, leaving the black lead where it is. The red lead should show you that the 12 volts went down that red wire in my example, and it went through that switch. The next thing after the switch is that it connects to one or two resistors, and now you go to those resistors. Is the voltage getting there? And then on the far side of the resistor, the voltage is going to be dropped through the resistor, but you're going to be signal tracing all the way down to the last component. You're going to watch the voltage, so to speak, walk around that wire, walk through that wire, through the switch, through the first resistor, through the first transistor, just by moving only the red lead, keeping track of where the red lead is touching and how many volts you measure and where that is on the schematic. If you have the schematic in front of you, you put a small red circle on each one of those spots on the schematic, and inside of that circle, you write down the number of volts you saw at that position. A smart guy looking at that diagram with those red circles with those voltages will say, aha, I see it. There it is. I know what's going on. Let me drop.
Quick suggestion also to...
Very fine, John. Get you in a second. So, and by the way, the fact that your circuit is super compact doesn't stop you. You may have to put a small piece of wire. You may have to take the tip of your voltmeter, which is too big to squeeze into the right position. You may have to wrap a piece of wire carefully around that tip, a very thin piece of wire, which is bare, and bring it out as a sharp little pointer out in front of the probe, and now stick that down inside of your circuit. As long as you've got the right kind of optical magnification, a great big magnifying glass, and a microscope or something like that, no matter how strong the circuit, how small the circuit is. I have worked on circuits, Jim, where my human eye could just barely see the components, the 0201 resistors, which look like a grain of sand as a surface mount component on a printed circuit board, and there's 13 of them all grouped together. And they're not touching each other, but they're all on that circuit board. You have to put that circuit board under a microscope to see what you're doing. You have to create a very sharp tip to your voltmeter red probe in order to probe each one of those resistors. But the fact that the circuit is small, that's not going to stop you. It's not going to slow you down. Relay it out if you want to. I don't think you have to. As long as you use the right tools and you know where that circuit is, in other words, you know that the 470 ohm resistor is in that position, and it goes from this point to that point, and you're going to measure the voltage on each end of it, in my example. Let's see what John's got to say. Wait for all four beeps and a little bit of a drop, John. Katie ACQ WGB, K2RIW in the tech man.
Resistors,
like grains of sand packed onto a super miniature printed circuit board. Back to you, Jim. KD2VHY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. What the subject you were explaining before. I took a negative battery lead in was supposed to go, and then right after that, in series, I would get the negative lead on my main.
I think the answer is no, Jim. You're going to leave the negative lead, the black lead from your voltmeter, on the minus 9-volt battery, and don't move it. The red lead, you're going to put the circuit wired in the normal manner. You're going to move the red lead to various places on the circuit and only measure with just the red lead compared to the black lead. The black lead doesn't move when you're making voltage measurements. And then you touch various places, particularly the on-off switch, and anything else you want to touch, and on your diagram, you write down what voltage is present at that point, measured with only the red lead doing the moving. The only time you're going to move both leads of your voltmeter is when you're trying to make a current measurement. There, to make current measurement, your meter must be in series with the lead coming out of the battery, for instance, to measure how much current is coming out of the battery. That's the one place where you move both leads simultaneously. But for this voltage test measurement you're going to be doing, black lead, negative lead of your voltmeter stays on the minus 9-volt lead of your battery, and now the red lead of your voltmeter, with the circuit wired in the normal manner, you just touch everything, tell us what voltage you see at those places, write it on the diagram, so to speak, take a picture or scan of that diagram, mail it to any of us, and that is a lot of information when you do that. Does that make some more sense, Jim? KD2BHY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
A little bit, so I'm just a little iggy on one part of the thing. Would I have the, because I have a connector that battery and then leads to these two leads, and do I put those in, or do I take the connection, the connection from the battery to the circuit out? Do I take those out?
The connection between the battery and the circuit, you would only be taking that out if you were going to make a current measurement so that you can put the meter in series with one of the leads out of the battery. But for this particular measurement, the battery is connected to the circuit in the normal manner. In other words, you're going to be using the circuit as if it works perfectly and you aren't making any measurements. The circuit is going to stay wired that way, everything plugged in. But by one means or another, the negative lead of your voltmeter will be connected to either the minus 9 volts of your battery directly at the battery or at somewhere in the circuit. If it's a clip lead, you're going to clip onto the circuit at the spot where the negative lead goes to, wherever that is, the so-called ground lead of the circuit. The negative lead, the black lead out of your voltmeter, is going to stay there and not move. The red lead, you're going to be measuring everything with battery plugged in through its circuit. Does that make a little more sense, Jim? KD2BHY, K2RIW in the TechNet. Jim, want to make another transmission?
Sorry, Dick, I think I might have been stepped on there, but, yeah, I understand now. I'll hopefully make those measurements tonight and maybe get back to you later on the TechNet.
Come back anytime, Jim. And what you're going through, Jim, right now is a very good learning curve. It's almost, there's an extra benefit that the first time you built the circuit, so to speak, right out of the box, it didn't work, so to speak. In the process of you doing this troubleshooting, and we're step-by-step leading you through it, it's a valuable tool to know you're going to use it for the rest of your electrical engineering life. Some of the best accolades I've ever gotten as an electronic engineer is because I walked into a laboratory where somebody was fiddling with a circuit for hours, couldn't get it to go, and I used some of these very simple signal tracing techniques. Either you trace the signal, or you trace the voltage and watch it flow through various circuits, write down those voltages on the diagram, and a smart person looking at those voltage magnitudes at those various positions on the diagram says, aha, I see what's going on. My red lead touched the top lead of that particular resistor, and I saw 3 volts. I touched the bottom lead of the same resistor, I saw 3 volts again. Therefore, I know that there's 0 voltage drop across that resistor. For whatever reason, that resistor is not doing anything. And that's a very strong clue. So even though some of the voltages you'll measure don't seem to make sense, as long as you know where you are on that circuit, and you can point to that point on the diagram, and you write down the voltage your red lead sees at that point in the diagram, with the black lead sitting in one fixed, grounded position, so to speak, that's some of the most valuable information you can get for voltage signal tracing, is what you're doing right now. Good luck with that. Come on back whenever you got that data. Okay, Greg was the next guy who signed in with a question. KD2, CXK, K2LIW. Go ahead, Greg.
KD2CXK, good morning. Good evening, Dick. I just quickly logged into Echo Link so I can get a better transmission here. My question is, I'm getting some noise on 80 and 160 meters coming from my power supply. Now, I don't have an Astron or anything. I have a Pyramid, one of these Pyramid 25-amp regulated fan-cooled power supplies. What would be the best method for me to filter out that noise? It seems to be some sort of harmonic hum possibly coming from the AC power. When I go to switch to battery power, I do have a battery backup for my rig, that noise goes completely away. It is undetectable on anything higher than 80 meters.
Okay, I think I understand your question, Greg. The Pyramid power supply that you're using, out of curiosity, do you think it is a switching type power supply, or it is a non-switching type, if you happen to know? Back to you, Greg.
It is a non-switching. It is a big, heavy, transformer-regulated power supply.
Okay, that's a good piece of information. And on 160 and 80 meters, you're fairly sure the power supply is making the noise. And by the way, one of the things you can do to confirm that is called signal sniffing. Another very useful technique. If you took a small piece of coaxial cable, piece of RG58 cable, connected to the receiver input, and the end of the receiver, the end of the cable, you just have a couple of inches of exposed center conductor. Exposed center conductor, in other words, you peeled away the shielding. And you don't even have to peel away the insulation. You just peeled away the shielding on the end of your piece of RG58 cable. So you've got a couple of inches of exposed center conductor as far as the shield not be there, but the dielectric material is there, and the shield you folded it back. And now you look, use the receiver in the normal receiving mode, and you hold it near the power supply. You wave it around the power supply. You wave it around the things in the room. It is a sniffing device. And as you get close to the object that's making the noise coming out of the receiver will go up dramatically. Because of the so-called inverse square law, if the power supply was making the noise, and quite possibly it is, when your sniffing wire is 3 feet away, you'll hear a certain amount of noise. At 1 feet away, the noise is going to get almost 10 dB louder. You then can go near the leads of the power supply. Is it coming out the 12-volt lead? Is it coming out the 110-volt power supply? The 110-volt input lead, and so on. That sniffing device, you'd be amazed how handy that is. So that way you'll double confirm that it's the power supply. There's a slim chance that when the power supply is supplying the rig, something else is making the noise. Now, the noise that you hear, you're saying it sounds like 60-cycle hum. Okay. Real 60-cycle hum.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
A real 60-cycle hum would not really be transmitted through the air. If the power supply as a analog type, the non-switching power supply, if the output regulating transistor was oscillating at, let me pick a number, half a megacycle, 500 KC, and you're listening to the third, fourth, and fifth harmonic when you're on 60 and 100 and, 160 and 80 meters. The fact that you can tune around to specific frequencies where you hear it will give you a hint. The combination of the switch sniffing device, what frequencies do you hear it? When you tune up the band to the high end versus the low end, does it get louder? Are there specific frequencies? Lots of clues along those lines, because occasionally the final transistor of a power supply can go into oscillation, depending on what load it sees. At light loading versus heavy loading, it'll go into a different frequency of oscillation, break into oscillation, not into oscillation. So I'm with you. I think there's a 90-some-odd% chance the power supply is doing it. But by the sniffing technique, you can now get the 99% confirmation, if you know what I mean. If you want to, with that shielded, the exposed semiconductor radio-wise, but it's shielded as far as leaving the insulation on it, there's no real exposed piece of wire, you can now start probing inside of the power supply itself and find out, does the signal get loudest when you're near that final output regulating transistor? You'd be amazed how handy that thing is. A ham radio receiver is an extremely good thing for doing sniffing of undesired signals. So the signal that you hear, is it a raspy sound? Is it a sharp sound like a pole pig? When you get arcing of power line, your Con Ed or your LIPA power lines, it gives a characteristic sound. Is that the sound that you're hearing?
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
E2HWW, Dick.
Yeah, how we recognize, get you in a second. So, Greg, describe to me the sound first, Greg. KD2CXK, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Dick, yeah, definitely the power supply. Like I mentioned, when I turn off that power supply and I switch over to my bank of gel cells, which I have 50 amps, of 12-volt gel batteries, that noise completely goes away. It's completely gone. When I switch it on, even if I can run parallel, I still get the noise. The batteries are not filtering out that noise, nor would I suspect they would. So it's definitely the power supply. If you ask me, it's pretty irrelevant if it's, what transistor it is, but it does confirm that I either have to change that power supply, find a way of filtering that through the DC output or isolating it, or don't work 1,850 meters. Or just deal with the noise. I guess I have four choices, correct? KD2CXK.
By that sniffing technique that I described, you can now find out, is the noise strongest on the 12-volt output lead? Is it strongest on the 110-volt input lead? That information is very handy. That tells you where to do filtering. By way of you tuning up and down the band, does it get louder or softer at the high end versus the low end? Is it on specific frequencies? Gives you a clue. Yes, there are various ways you can bypass the power supply. However, in some cases, that becomes a sort of a brute force technique, which is addressing the symptom, not the cause. If there really is an oscillating transistor in there, or an oscillating voltage regulator, maybe you want to fix the oscillating voltage regulator and make the problem go away at the source. Because if there really is an oscillating transistor, and you put lots of great big filter capacitors everywhere, and input ferrite beads on the input 110-volt lead, and each of these techniques are going to knock down the noise a certain number of decibels, but none of them are going to make the noise go to zero. Depending on how sensitive you want your receiver to be on 80 and 160 meters, you'd like to not have any locally generated noise in the shack to compete with the signals you want to listen to. So finding out the next step of where is it coming from, and maybe you want to substitute the power supply and just give up entirely. That's a possible approach. But I like finding out what's going on. I like fixing things. So I would go the next step to find out what is doing it. Because, as I said, just bypassing it is going to knock it down by 20 dB, heroic bypassing, but you'll never make the noise go to zero if you don't attack it at the source. That's my opinion. Let's see what Howie's got to say, because I bet you he's done this kind of troubleshooting. So it'll be B2HWW, K2RIW. Go ahead, Howie.
The question I want to know, does he hear this noise when there's a station on frequency? Depending on that answer, I'll have an answer. I'll have an answer to that. I'd like to know, does he hear that noise only when there's a station? Does he hear it dead silence? If he disconnects his antenna, does he still hear the noise?
Another couple of very good tests. Back to you, Greg.
I hear it all the time. It doesn't matter if the antenna is connected or not. It does not matter if I resonate the antenna with the tuner or not. It doesn't matter if I'm listening to a station or anything. If I'm on those bands, I hear that noise. It's louder on 160 meters than on 80 meters.
Wow, you just said a mouthful. If you thoroughly disconnect the antenna from the rig, and the noise doesn't change in amplitude, the noise stays the same. Is that what you're saying, Greg? If that noise is coming out of your radio with no antenna connection, or maybe just a 50-ohm dummy load resistor on the input of the receiver, if you're hearing it then, that is very different. The fact that it goes away under a battery is a good sign, but is there something funny going on with the compatibility between power supply and radio? The fact that you hear it without an antenna connection, in other words, just an open circuit on the connector input to the receiver, if that's what you're saying, that's another whole kettle of fish, if you know what I mean here, Greg. So back to you for a repeat on that one, Greg. KD2CXK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
AC2QIQ in the comment.
Okay, stand by, Greg. Go ahead, Glenn. Glenn, what do you think is going on?
Typically, I've seen these kinds of problems where there's the Amtrans also do similar things at times where it depends on the rectifier that they use inside these power supplies. A lot of times there's a bridge rectifier, and it's the recovery through zero crossing generates a spike. And this will happen even at very low frequencies, 1620 hertz, and it's picked up as common mode, and it usually isn't visible on the output ripple. So in other words, if you look at the output, it looks nice and clean with an oscilloscope, and most of this noise is really being conducted back through the AC power line, and usually a good way of getting rid of it is either beefing up the common mode filter capacitance between line to chassis, or basically just going out and buying a good storm sheet type of EMI filter that you can put in line with the power line, going back to the AC power outlet, Dick. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Greg, you made some good suggestions. Glenn, you made some good suggestions, but let me run by again now the fact that he disconnects the antenna from the rig and the noise is still there. You're suggesting that if it was the crossover glitching of the bridge rectifier, that noise is walking up the 110-volt lead of the power supply, and somehow that being coupled to the 110-volt lead going into the receiver is coming out of the receiver. He has no antenna connected to the receiver when he's hearing the 160 and 80-meter spiky 60-cycle noise. Now back to you, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, I would expect that, Dick, and the main reason why is because the IF on 160 and 40 are different. So there's usually the where the IF is crossing over, and I think probably by the time he gets to the 40 meter band, the IF is switched to such a level that it's ignoring it. But when he's getting down to 160, it's common mode interference, and it's interfering with the IF. So it doesn't even have to go through the input RF stages on the input in order to basically radiate through the chassis. And the frequencies are so low, like you said, typically if you get a recovery snap on a rectifier, it'll ring all the way back through the chassis into the common mode, and it's probably only a few hundred kilohertz of, because it's a very, very sharp spike kind of a problem. That's why there's more energy in the IF at 160 than there is at 80.
Wow. So you suggested that that signal is walking through the shielding of the rig and the shielding of the power supply in order to get there even with no antenna connection. You've got a bit of a mystery here from my point of view, Greg. The fact that you